describe the expansion of the universe, and we derived the equations, and we saw they connect the expansion rate of the universe to the age of the universe, probably the most amazing physics that we know, an equation that describes the whole universe. But so this time we're going to talk about black holes, which are the most interesting objects in physics, the most paradoxical objects, and also solutions of the Einstein equations. So these objects continue to be of enormous interest, both theoretically, because they raise a lot of paradoxes. It seems that if you fall into a black hole, you hit a singularity and general relativity breaks down and nobody's quite sure what happens next. There are questions about whether they're consistent with quantum mechanics, whether information is lost in a black hole, or whether it reemerges in the radiation from a black hole as it disappears. And observationally, they're tremendously exciting, because in the last decade or so, it's become clear that black holes are everywhere in the universe, not just in the center of almost every galaxy, but in the outskirts of many, many galaxies, there are hundreds of black holes. And so the universe, in many ways, the black holes are a prime feature of the universe. They play a role in galaxy formation. Galaxy formation occurs by matter clumping under gravity, again, as described by Einstein equations. But the black holes play a very important role in accreting matter and then radiating very intense bursts of X-rays, intense radiation that heats up the matter and prevents it falling further and falling into galaxies and forming stars. So the black holes play a huge role in the feedback process that suppresses the formation of galaxies at late times in the universe. So these black holes are really, really important. And the exciting thing now is that within the next 10 years, we will actually be examining black holes in detail. One of our young faculty, Avery Broderick, is the world leader in imaging black holes using very long baseline interferometry. And he actually has pictures that show a little dark patch in the radiation coming from the center of the galaxy. And that dark patch, we believe, is the horizon of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And likewise, people here like Louis Lehner are involved in computing what happens when two black holes merge into one and create a burst of gravitational waves, as well as electromagnetic and other radiation. And that will almost certainly be seen, these bursts of gravitational radiation will almost certainly be seen within the next 10 years. So that's a very exciting field, that we will have direct evidence about strong gravity, solutions of the field equations when the deviation from flat space is enormous. Now we're going to study black holes. These are, in many ways, the simplest solutions to the Einstein equations, but at the same time, the most paradoxical. So we want to study spherically symmetric. This is just to make life easy. Spherical symmetry. Realistic black holes are not spherically symmetric. Realistic black holes have some angular momentum, and that gives them an axis. And so they're rotating. I'm not sure if I'm going to have time to describe them at the end of the course. If you want to have an introduction to them, you may look at previous years where I did have more time and I did discuss Kerr black holes. But we're just going to do the simplest spherically symmetric black holes. So spherically symmetric solutions of the vacuum Einstein equations. And we're going to assume, we're going to neglect the dark energy, neglect a cosmological constant. Wouldn't be too hard to put it in, but we're going to neglect it for now. And so we're just going to be solving G alpha beta equals zero. Let me pull that down. So we want spherical symmetry. Now, spherical symmetry means there have to be three Killing vectors, that you want the idea that you should be able to rotate this object around three independent axes. And so we want to consider a metric, which is, in principle, a function of time. Time doesn't change under rotations. And three spatial coordinates, x, y, and z. And we want it to be symmetric under x prime equals ox, where O equals O transpose O equals 1, O equals a rotation. Okay, O 3. A rotation matrix is generated by three generators, which represent rotations around the x or the y or the z axis. And we want this function to be symmetric. We want the metric to be symmetric under such rotations. So the line element should be built from, should depend only on rotational invariance. E.g., dt, that's rotational invariant. T is fine. R, which would be the square root of x squared, that's fine. That's rotation invariant. X dot dx is r dr. That's rotation invariant, because if I rotate x and dx the same way, that quantity is invariant. And of course, dx squared, which would be dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared, where, of course, as usual, I write x is equal to r sine theta cos phi, r sine theta sine phi, and r cos theta. Okay, so provided I build my metric out of those quantities, it will be invariant under rotations. So the most general line element you can write down, d tau squared, will be something times dt squared. And I'll put a minus sign, just anticipating that c is going to be positive in the end. Plus something else, some other function of r and t times dr squared. Now, you can certainly have off-diagonal elements of the metric. Okay, and so that is the most general line element you can write down, which is built out of these O3 invariant quantities. Sorry? Oh, yeah, actually, I should call it ds. Let's call it ds. Because d tau would have a minus sign. Yeah, let's call it ds. So by this, I just mean g mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, so this is the most general O3 invariant line element that you can write down. But there's still a lot of freedom to simplify it because nobody said you had to use these coordinates. You could use any coordinates you like, which simplify the problem. And so the first simplification is to just redefine this quantity as R prime squared. Okay, so that would mean that the area of a surface, which is parameterized by theta and phi, the area is just going to be 4 pi r squared. Okay, because if I fix r, these and t, these parts of the metric don't contribute at all. So I'm just considering a two-dimensional subspace of four dimensions at fixed r and fixed t, and that two-dimensional subspace has an area given by integrating this over the range of theta and phi, and the area is just 4 pi r squared. So why not just define that quantity to be r prime squared? And we're going to do that throughout. Okay, so in the simplest coordinates for a black hole, we simply choose the coefficient of the two-dimensional metric on the two-sphere to be r squared. And that guarantees that the area of any surface surrounding the black hole is just 4 pi r prime squared. Okay, so I'm going to define this as r prime squared and then drop the prime. Okay, so my new metric is just that, but with r squared. Yep.
But f depends on t in principle, right?
Doesn't matter. Just define this as r prime squared. It's a function of r and t. You're allowed to do two coordinate transformations where the new coordinates are any function of the old coordinates. So that's your definition. And then when you do that, of course, this will become, goes to dr prime, right? With some dt primes, because there's a t involved. But all of that will just mix up these terms, okay? And so all it's going to do is create various terms like this of the same form, and it won't change anything. Okay, so that's completely general. You can always do that. And now we have that ds squared is equal to minus c of r and t, dt squared plus d of r and t, dr squared. So I've transformed these r's and t's into r prime and t, plus 2e of r and t, dr dt, plus r squared. And I'll write the two-sphere metric as c omega 2 squared. Now, the next part of the argument is we'd like to really get rid of this e, the off-diagonal part of the metric. It's just much simpler to think about diagonal metrics. And so let's try and remove e. And the way we do this is to define a new time, dt prime. Roughly speaking, we want to complete the square and write this as a sum of squares. And so we define a new time, dt prime, to be eta r and t times c of r and t dt minus e of r and t dr. You see, The reason I'm doing this is that in this metric, I've got a C minus 2E. And if I squared that quantity, I would get C squared minus 2EC, okay, which is C. So I'm just writing, just motivating this. C minus E squared goes like C squared minus 2CE plus E squared. And these, of course, come with the dt and the dr. This term is what we have here. We've got a c dt minus 2. So this is c times c minus 2e. Okay, so that's what we're attempting to do here, is reproduce that cross term by defining a new dt prime, so that dt prime squared is going to generate this term. Relative to that one. And okay, so that's the definition of dt prime. This factor eta is what we call an integrating factor. It's designed to ensure the coordinate transformation exists. Okay, and let me explain why you need the eta. Well, if this is a correct equation, then it implies then dt prime is, of course, dt prime dt times dt plus dt prime dr times dr. Okay, so it must be that dt prime, the partial derivative of dt prime dt at fixed r is equal to the first two terms, and the partial derivative of dt prime dr, this one would have to be minus eta e. Now, if that's true, you have the identity that dt prime dt dr equals dt prime dr dt. Partial differentiation commutes. And so you have an identity which relates eta c to eta e. And so you have d2, this is d2, t prime dr dt, which is equal to d by dr of eta e. Let me put explicitly the r and t dependence. Is equal to d2 t prime dt dr, which is minus d by dt eta r t e r t. Sorry, the first one is c. Okay, so dt prime dt was eta c. And so d by dr of eta c must be equal to d by dt minus d by dt of eta e. So just in order for this function t prime to exist. Now, let's just look at this differential equation. This equals that. So this is a differential equation. So given C of R and T and E of R and T, this is a differential equation for eta of r and t. Okay, so it wouldn't be true if I just had eta equals 1. There's no reason why this equation would be true. But actually, I can view this equation as an evolution equation for eta. Okay, so given, so for some, so for any eta of r at t0, some initial time, the equation determines eta r and t for t bigger than t naught. Okay, that's assuming e is non-zero, which we'll just assume. If e is non-zero, then you can always regard this equation as an equation for d by dt of eta. So this allows you to this equation gives you d eta dt as a function of eta. Now you know eta, so you can just step forward eta in time, and eta will be completely determined by that differential equation. Okay, so in general, you expect this equation to have a solution. And if so, then I can simply substitute that formula into the previous formula. And what we find is that ds squared equals the following, minus dt prime squared over eta squared c plus d plus c inverse e dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. Okay, so that's the claim, is the original metric is now diagonal in this new coordinates. Let's check that. So dt prime squared, obviously the eta squared is going to cancel. I'm going to get c squared dt squared, but the 1 over c will cancel the fact one of the c's. Minus 2ce, this will cancel the c in that term, plus e squared dr squared over c. And sorry, that should be an e squared here. So here I'm getting, from the square, I get minus e squared dr squared over c. And that will precisely cancel this term. And then I'm left with the same metric. OK, so we've succeeded in diagonalizing the metric. And so now let's redefine these functions to be b of r and t dt squared, so just by definition, plus a of r and t dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. OK, so this is the most general spherically symmetric metric, but in coordinates which have been chosen to make the metric diagonal.
Couple of questions. The first, when you redefine the, you combine the f of r t with the r,
right?
And you get the r prime. Now that r prime is a function of r and t.
That's right.
And so whatever cross terms you get, they just happen to cancel out when you.
No, they don't cancel. So let's just do it explicitly. R prime is equal to f to the 1/2 r of t. Okay, we're going to assume f is positive. Times r. Okay, so what this means, so, and of course, t prime is equal to t. That's the coordinate transformation from my original r and t to the new r and t. Okay, so now what I do is I want to transform the metric to these coordinates. So all I do is work out the Jacobian matrix, right? So I work out dr prime dr, and I work out dr prime dt, and dt prime dr, which happens to be 0. and dt prime dt, which happens to be 1. Okay, so this is equal to dx prime dx. Okay, forgetting about the theta terms. Let's not worry about the theta and phi. That nothing happens in those directions. Well, this coordinate transformation is, so dr prime dr, I have to differentiate this thing. It's a mess. Now we invert it, right? So dx prime dx is just the 2x2 matrix that inverts this. So I write 1 over the determinant. And then I, it's the, It's a matrix of cofactors, right? dr prime dr, 1 minus, well, there's a 0 here, minus dr prime dt. So you can just invert this matrix. And then you define the new metric as equal to dx prime. Sorry, this is dx prime dx. dx dx prime is the inverse metric. dx dx prime g. Okay, and that's it. So all you're going to do is take those coefficients, the c, d, e, and form a matrix, and just multiply this matrix by it twice to form this, and that's the new metric. Okay? Or equivalently, you could think of it another way. Conceptually, you could think, oh, well, I have this transformation, let's invert it. All right, so if I know what f is, there should be some expression that r is equal to r of r prime t prime. And t is equal to t of r prime t prime, right? And now I just compute dr as dr dr prime plus dr dt dt prime, etc. Right? And substitute these things back into the metric. So as long as you have a coordinate transformation, you can convert the metric in one coordinates into another. But it's never going to change the form of the first metric because that's completely general, right? So it will change the explicit function c. C is now going to be some mixture of derivatives of f and so on, as well as c. But because it was completely general, you're not going to change it. That's all I mean. Okay.
And could you briefly explain this differential equation again from when you go from dt prime?
This one?
This line on.
Yes. Okay. So the claim is that there exists a coordinate transformation like that. That there exists a t prime such that dt prime is proportional to cdt minus edr. And I pick that combination, as I explained, because if I square it, the cross term is proportional to the dt squared term with a factor of 2e. Okay? And which is what I want to cancel. So the claim is there is a solution to this equation. There is a dt prime. So to check that, let us... So to check that, notice that if so, dt prime dt must be this guy, dt prime dr must be that guy. And then from the equality of these mixed partial derivatives, because partial derivatives commute, you must have this identity. Okay? And in fact, there is a theorem in PDEs that providing you satisfy the equality of partial derivatives, then the function actually exists. Okay, so I'm not proving that. I'm just relying on it. And so you have to check. So we've shown this is a necessary condition. We haven't shown it's sufficient. But now I can argue, having written down the condition, that there should be a solution of this equation. Because I regard this as a time evolution equation for eta. So given eta at some initial time as a function of r, which is arbitrary, I can work out the time derivative of eta. And that allows me to work out eta at t plus dt, right? Eta t plus dt is just eta at t plus dt times eta dot. But I've got eta dot from here. And so I can work eta out at the next time step. If you've done any numerical work, you'd know exactly this is exactly what you do. You just work out the time derivative and step the function forward using the time derivative equation. So the existence of this time evolution equation for eta means that if this is t and this is r, and if I know eta at this time as a function of r, I can just step it forward. I can evolve eta forward using this equation. Okay, so that makes it plausible that this function eta exists. In the end, we don't care what it is, because we're going to redefine it as part of this completely general coefficient. So all we really care is that it exists. We don't really care what its value is. Okay, so I hope that makes it plausible that... that this is actually the most general, time-dependent, spherically symmetric metric. Okay, so the above is the most general, time-dependent, spherically symmetric metric. Okay, so you always have this feature in general relativity, is that the metric doesn't really mean anything until you specify what coordinates you're in, and the form of the metric changes from one form of the from one coordinate system to another, and so you have to keep in mind that the object you're really interested in is the metric modulo coordinate transformation. So we can always put a time-dependent, spherically symmetric metric into that form, that diagonal form. Okay, now it is just straightforward algebra to write down the Einstein equations. Of course, G alpha beta equals zero. This is the same as R alpha beta minus 1/2 G alpha beta R equals zero. Okay. But if I trace this equation, then what I get is r minus, and then a factor of 4 over 2, because g alpha beta is 4, equals 0. And this implies that r equals 0. So actually, the vacuum Einstein equations with no dark energy or cosmological constant, the vacuum Einstein equations are just that the Ricci tensor has to be zero. Okay, so that's all we have to calculate, is the Ricci tensor for this time-dependent, spherically symmetric metric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just showed that. Never mind.
If this equation is true, then this equation is true, okay, and vice versa. I mean, this equation is actually completely equivalent to that equation. The R, because this equation implies R equals 0, this equation also implies R equals 0. So either of these equations imply that the Ricci scalar is 0.
So how do we know from the fact that the scalar is 0 that the tensor is 0?
We don't know. Oh, no. This is the field equation, the Einstein field equation.
Yeah.
I can prove from this field equation that the Ricci curvature is zero, okay? Because g alpha beta is actually equal to, from this calculation, minus r, okay? So it follows from this equation that r is zero. But if r is zero, well, then g is equal to r alpha beta. If R, by definition, G alpha beta was R alpha beta minus 1/2 R G alpha beta. That was the definition of G.
Okay.
So from the field equation, it follows R is 0, and therefore it follows the tensor, Ricci tensor, is 0. OK, so all we have to do is calculate the Ricci tensor for this metric. And maybe in one of your problem classes, you'll use a Mathematica code or something to do that. It's rather easy. But since this is such an important and simple metric, let's just do it. It's really not very hard. Let's start by working out gamma TTT. And if you remember, this would be for example, given by this equation. Let me justify that. The metric is diagonal, of course, right? So if you specify this index as a t, that means this is 0. The other one has to be 0 because diagonal. And if that one's 0, then whatever it's contracted with must be 0. And these two are 0, so the other two have to be zeros. Okay. And so from this, we can read off from the metric G00 is B, G00 upstairs is one over B, is minus 1 over B. This guy is B, is minus B. And so this is simply 1 half B dot over B. Okay. I'm going to define dot to be D by DT. And prime to be d by dr, just to make life a little simpler. The next thing we should consider is gamma t t r. One of the indices is r instead of t. This will be equal to gamma t r t, because gamma is symmetric. We're assuming zero torsion. And so for this one, we get 1 half. G00, same argument. If this index is 0, that one must be 0 because it's diagonal. And then we have GR0, 0 plus G00, R minus GR0, 0. These two things cancel. Well, they're actually 0 anyway. These are 0 because they're off diagonal. These are both 0. And so then I'm left with 1 half G00 dot, sorry, G00 comma R. So that gives me 1 half B prime over B, etc. OK, so I just did a few, just did two of them. I'll leave you to check the others. Let me just write them down. And so we have gamma TRR is equal to 1 half A dot over B. Gamma RRT equals gamma RTR is A dot over 2A. Gamma RTT is equal to B prime over 2A. Gamma RRR is equal to A prime over 2A. Gamma R theta theta is equal to minus R over A. Gamma R phi phi is equal to minus R sine squared theta over A. Gamma theta theta R equals gamma theta theta R equals 1 over R. Gamma theta phi phi is minus sine theta cos theta. Gamma phi phi r, gamma phi phi r equals whatever r, gamma theta equals gamma phi phi theta equals cot theta. So that's everything. And now we work out the Ricci tensor. R mu kappa is minus is R lambda mu lambda kappa is equal to minus gamma lambda mu lambda kappa plus gamma mu kappa comma lambda plus gamma eta mu lambda lambda kappa eta gamma eta mu kappa gamma lambda eta lambda. So that's just the formula we used before. And from this, it follows that RRR, let me do TT first. Okay, so that's it, and in fact the other components R theta, R phi, R theta t, R phi t, R zero. Because by spherical symmetry. Okay, so you can calculate them, but they are guaranteed to be zero because of spherical symmetry. There's one more. R phi phi is trivial, is related to R theta theta by also by the spherical symmetry. So we have to solve these four coupled partial differential equations for A and B. And it turns out to be amazingly simple. Okay, so we have to solve these four coupled nonlinear partial differential equations for A of R and T and B of R and T. And for this simplest metric, it turns out to be extremely simple. As soon as you get to more complicated metrics describing rotating black holes or black holes in the presence of other fields and matter, it becomes much more difficult. But the first thing to notice, so it's amazingly simple here. And so tell me which equation I should use first. Pardon? The third one looks good, right? So let's think about what that means. RRT equals 0. This implies that d by dt of A of R and T equals 0, right? Therefore, A is independent of T. That implies that A is A of R only. There's no time dependence at all in the function A. Okay? Now, if that's true, you notice all these terms here disappear. Okay? So all time derivatives disappear from the equations. So the equations are only PDEs in radius. And sorry?
Your function B can also depend on time, right? And
sorry, what can depend on time?
B.
B can, in principle, depend on time.
But I mean, if I only just watch that A doesn't depend on time, then there's no way I can determine the dependence of time B, right?
We're going to fix that in one moment. We'll fix that in one moment. But it's a good point. In principle, B can depend on time at this stage of the calculation. We'll see exactly how the time dependence of B disappears in a moment. Okay, so now what we want to do is look at the remaining equations and somehow simplify them. So all the stuff in the box is gone, and I want to simplify these. So any ideas?
A times the first one plus B times the second one.
Very good, very good. So let's take, in fact, I'm going to divide the first one by B and add the second one over A. And the point of that is to get rid of the second derivative terms here. Okay. And what I get is just A prime over A squared R plus B prime over AB, R, and that's got to be 0. Let's just check that. So you see these two terms cancel. This term cancels with that term, and this term cancels with that term. Okay, so I'm just left with the B prime and the A prime terms. But this is pretty simple, because that implies that AB prime equals 0. And so AB is equal to a function of T only. Okay, because AB, quantity AB, must be independent of R. So it can only be a function of time. Now we impose boundary conditions. Whenever we solve differential equations, we almost always need some boundary conditions. We want the space-time to be asymptotically Minkowski at large R. Okay, so we're looking for some object that is localized in space around R equals 0. But as we go off to R equals infinity, we want the space to become flat space, just Minkowski space. And so that implies that A should tend to 1 as, and B should tend to 1 as R tends to infinity. Okay, but right away, if A and B are both tending to 1 at large R, then this function of T has to be 1. Okay, because it's the right-hand side, f of t equals 1. Okay, so
how does the larger large of the fact that it asymptotically approaches and Minkowski at larger imply that it A goes to 1?
Because if you look at the metric, which is up there, you see we want that metric.
Oh,
we want the S squared to go to minus dt squared plus dr squared plus r squared d omega 2 squared. So A has to go to 1 and B has to go to 1. So that's a boundary condition. So we can take this equation at r equals infinity, still valid there. It's valid for any r. Take it at r equals infinity. These are 1, so f must be 1. But if f is 1, then, of course, B is equal to 1 over A, and that means B is only a function of R. It doesn't. So all the time dependence disappears due to the boundary conditions at infinity. And the final equation we want to use, so now we'll use the last equation, R theta theta. So R theta theta is over here. A is 1 over B. So R theta theta is 1 minus B. And then A is 1 over B. So A prime is minus B prime over B squared. A is 1 over B. So that cancels the b squared term. So I get minus rb prime over 2 from here, another rb prime over 2 from the second term. So I get minus rb prime. And this implies, so here, and this, of course, has to be 0. So this implies rb prime equals 1. And that implies that RB is equal to R plus a constant, C. C is a constant. And this implies that B is equal to 1 plus C over R. And of course, A equals 1 over 1 plus C over R. So that's the solution. Very, very simple solution of the field equations. And amazingly general. Very simple and very general. That the most general time-dependent spherically symmetric solution of different of general relativity just has one parameter in it, parameter c. And this fact that all the time dependence disappears and that you have a unique solution is called the Birkhoff theorem. Now, in fact, we can identify the constant rather easily at large R. So let's consider a mass M, e.g. the Sun or Earth. Okay, then at large R, the gravitational potential from the Earth is minus gm over r. And recall from the correspondence with Newton that h naught naught, this is the deviation of the metric from flat space, is minus 2 phi over c squared, where phi is the Newtonian potential. And so that implies that g naught naught is approximately minus 1 plus h naught naught, which is minus 2 phi over c squared. And that's equal to, from Newtonian theory, minus 1 minus 2gm over rc squared. And so we have the b. So this fixes the constant c, the constant c that b is equal to 1 minus 2gm over rc squared, and a is equal to b inverse. So the line element ds squared is equal to this is called the Schwarzschild metric. Discovered in 1915. So very, very soon after the discovery of the equations of general relativity, this solution was found. Yeah?
So we considered the vacuum solution, and then now we're putting it in maps.
Yeah, good question. Okay. So what was... So the picture is the following. Let me draw a picture of this on the board. Picture is the following. We're imagining the sun, right? And then we are solving the Einstein equations outside the sun, but with spherical symmetry and with a boundary condition that we tend to flat space. Okay? So the Schwarzschild metric is valid here. If this is the radius of the sun, the Schwarzschild metric is valid for outside the sun. I.e. for r bigger than r sun. Okay? So it's only valid there. It's only valid outside the sun. If we solve the field equations inside the sun, we're going to find different functions of r. So roughly speaking, let's see, b looks like this. So let's look at rs. B is going to go like 1 minus 1 over r. So sorry, 1 minus 1 over r. B looks like this. Okay, B goes like 1 minus 2gm over rc squared. It tends to 1. The solution is only valid for r outside r sun. Okay? Now, if you solve the field equations inside the sun, it's pretty clear what's going to happen, that locally you better get flat space as you go to the center of the sun, right? Because locally, that's just a point. Okay, there's some matter there, but it's not extreme. And so if you solve the field equations inside the sun, you're just going to do this. B is the coefficient of... B is the coefficient of... got the metric. It's a coefficient of dt. So b is going to go to a constant inside the sun. So it will do something like this inside the sun, because locally it's going to be a piece of Minkowski space as well.
So the argument is a bit odd for you, because we're saying that, let's say we have some mass over here, but we'll get the vacuum solutions. And we're saying the vacuum solutions are valid everywhere.
They're very anywhere outside the black hole.
You require that your metric is continuous.
Okay. Yes. So you see, the exterior solution is amazingly general. It's even true if there's time dependent. So imagine that the sun exploded, okay? But it explodes in a spherically... So imagine this explodes. Actually, it is going to explode. I think 3 billion years from now, the sun is going to become a red giant. It's going to explode and swallow up the Earth. Okay? So imagine that it explodes, but in a spherically symmetric manner. Good old Schwarzschild is still valid outside. And so what it means is there's absolutely no warning. You're sitting here, this shell is coming out up to the speed of light, and there is no warning here. You still see exactly the same metric until it hits you. And then, you're crushed or burned or whatever.
Wait, won't you see the light?
Pardon?
Right?
No, because it goes at the speed of light. You have to wait. You have to wait for it to hit you. Yeah.
So we started off simplifying the metric by saying that we're going to absorb this F into R. So is our R here not now time dependent?
Oh, good. R is a coordinate. I mean, I think once you have the metric, it's up to you to infer what R is. I mean, R is some coordinate. That's all it is.
So we
and the old coordinate was equally good or equally bad. So just forget about the old one. Just look at this metric and say, what does it mean?
But
there's nothing significant about the original R.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the original R we interpreted as like a distance and three-dimensional space, so this R no longer has
oh,
the same
I see what you mean. This is its rotational properties?
Well, I mean, if
yeah.
we wanted to, like, could we say this R is the R we measure
not
sitting here?
No.
Right?
This R is the one such that if I surround the sun with a surface, right, a spherically symmetric surface, and I measure the area locally, I go with a meter ruler and I measure that area, the area will be 4 pi R squared. That's the definition of this R. Okay, so this... This is defined so that a constant R surface has area exactly 4 pi R squared.
But it doesn't have the interpretation of a physical like distance from the origin or something.
Not at all.
Yeah,
not
I mean,
at all.
That part's, it's just
not
this,
at
this
all.
Surface area.
It's just the area of the surface.
But we're still
yeah.
assuming that large R means far away. This, even though
we're assuming large R is
so
far away.
So that's saying something about F, that F was not some 1 over R cubed or something, because in that case then large R would not be far
yeah,
away.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there are implicit in this a number of assumptions,
yeah.
like I assumed E didn't vanish, and then I assumed F. So you may find some pathological cases which you could go back and look at and see if you got some different metric. But this is the generic story. Go ahead.
Well, one thing, are you missing a C squared in front of the dt squared?
Yes, you're right. Thank you. It's not
C's.
Really. I'm not being completely consistent with my C's.
Or just said C to 1.
You're absolutely right. I prefer to put a C in there. You know, this is kind of obviously a dimensionless quantity, gm over r divided by velocity squared. So I like to leave the C in there. But yeah, strictly speaking, I should have put my C's back everywhere else.
So if this
yeah,
r is
fun.
Not, I don't exactly understand the thing. So if R does not represent a distance from the center,
no.
it only represents in some sense how...
It represents the area. So literally you take your spaceship and you stay at fixed, let's say, you circulate the star at fixed gravitational potential and you measure the area around that surface, you'll find 4 pi R squared. That's the definition of R. Because that's the way I defined it, that the coefficient of the angular part of the metric was R squared. Yeah.
So somehow, during the derivation, we had to actually assume that that the metric is isotropic with that.
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, apparently this actually is part of the statement of Birkhoff's theorem. So is there an easy way to see why this must be true?
No. it doesn't have to be true. It's an assumption.
Okay.
So, for example, if we solve for a black hole with a lambda, with a dark energy, you'll find what's called the de Sitter black hole. And the de Sitter black hole has a different structure than this one. When you go to large radius, you're going to find de Sitter space. It's not Minkowski space at all. It's going to be this big hyperboloid. Okay, so the boundary conditions are essential in fixing the form of the Schwarzschild metric.
Even without no cosmology constant.
Yeah, let me think about that. You see, so if we hadn't assumed it went to 1, so if there was some time dependence, yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I'm not sure what metric will emerge. So if you assume that f of t is not 1, and you continue to solve the equations. My suspicion, but it would have to be checked, is that you will discover a singular solution. You'll find a solution which, at some finite radius, A or B blows up, and then you can't go beyond there. Think of electrostatics. You solve Poisson's equation for the electrostatic potential. So typically, you find one solution that goes like 1 over r. So that one is regular at large r, but singular at small r, as this is. And you have another solution where phi could be r. And that one blows up at infinity. And so that solution blows up at infinity, but it's regular at small r. So there will be another solution here which is singular. Essentially, what it will represent, I believe, is some kind of anisotropic cosmology, which will have a singularity. So you're allowing this time dependence. Let me just see if I. Yeah, I mean the Einstein equations have other time dependent solutions. One example is a Kasner metric, where the different components have different time dependence. And I suspect that you'll end up with
just as a general principle, like why is having why is being singular at a certain large value of r actually a problem? Like the whole thing about general relativity is that
right.
Only
it's local.
That it's it's valid locally. So
right,
this metric is singular anyway.
It's singular. Yeah, it's singular at r equals this radius.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so it's singular anyway. That's true. It's not singular at large r. It's not singular in the weak field approximation. So this is basically a question of what are the right boundary conditions at large distance. And essentially, this is a question about why is the universe simple on large scales. And that's a question, as you say, it's beyond gr. Gr can't solve that question. That's a question for cosmology. Okay. So ultimately, we need an explanation for this boundary condition. You know, why is the space nearly flat at large distances? Why isn't something crazy happening out there? And GR just doesn't explain that. Okay, you need some boundary condition on GR. So that's the whole business of cosmology, is to explain the right global properties or large-scale properties of the metric. So I'm sort of copping out of the question, but I hope you understand. That's because there isn't a clear answer. Okay, so yeah.
So you gave the physical interpretation of R, but how do we get the physical interpretation of T?
Physical interpretation of T is to go to large R, and then T is the time measured by an observer at very large R. Okay, so if you have an observer in Minkowski space that is not moving with respect to the coordinates x, then t is the time that observer measures. T is the proper time measured by a clock that's standing still. Okay, and so if you put somebody at large r and they're not moving in radius, so you can ignore this term, and they're not moving in angle, they're just sitting there at large r, then t is actually the time they measure at large r. If you happen to put something, you notice that I drew this graph. So b is, of course, changing with radius. And inside the star, b would take a different value than 1. And likewise for a will be some other thing. It's not even 1 over b. Okay, a is 1 over b outside the star. But inside it's different. So they will each tend to some constant value inside the star. If you ask what's the time measured by somebody inside the star, it actually would be determined by those constants. So different observers measure, the clocks run at different rates according to where they are in the gravitational field. But T is the time measured by somebody a long way away from the black hole who's not moving towards it or away from it. Okay, so now I want to go on to study the motion of particles inside this black hole. outside and inside, we're actually going to fall into the black hole. That's what gets pretty exciting.
Just before you carry on, is there some way to see what the radius of the sun is using these equations?
Oh, do you want to know how big that number is?
I mean, how you see what it is. How you get it. Is it the
point
where
I see.
That
no.
Singular?
No. Okay, so M represents the mass of the object, okay? And the way I identified it is by looking at the behavior at large radius and saying this has got to agree with Newton's theory in weak gravitational potentials. So at large radius, gravitational potential is weak. So I can read off the relationship between the metric perturbation and in the Einstein theory and Newton's description, and that's how I got the number M. But it was just an integration constant. So if you want to know where is the radius of the star, you've got to know the equations for the density and pressure of the star. You've got to know how dense it is. You know, all you know is the mass from this. You do not know where the vacuum solution turns into the solution with stress energy.
So as yet, we don't have any interpretation for this point where this blows up?
Not at all. Okay, that's a different question. Okay, let me talk a little bit about that. So note, okay, Schwarzschild metric. Is singular, meaning the coefficients blow up, or go to zero at R equals to 2gm over c squared. And that, by definition, is the Schwarzschild radius. And for a long time, until the 1960s, people thought that was a real singularity in this metric. Okay, but then in the 1960s, it was realized that this is actually just a coordinate singularity. Just a coordinate singularity. You can fall through let's call the Schwarzschild radius RS. You can fall through RS perfectly smoothly. Okay, so according to general relativity, if you fall towards this radius, the Schwarzschild radius, and imagine there is no sun, you know, one resolution is that the Schwarzschild radius is inside the matter, and therefore the solution isn't valid there. So, for example, for the sun, if you work out, I mean, G is what? 6.7 times 10 to the minus 11. M sun is 2 times 10 to the 30 kilograms. 2gm over c squared would be how much? Somebody knows the answer. 3 kilometers. Okay, you can check it. So the Schwarzschild radius of the sun is 3 kilometers, which is a lot smaller than the sun. Okay, so the resolution in that case is just that the Schwarzschild metric is only valid to the radius of the sun. And inside the sun, I've got to solve some other equations. And there won't be any singularity in the solution. Everything will be fine. But imagine the sun collapses, right, as it eventually will. After all, it exhausts all of its energy and pressure. The sun will eventually collapse probably collapse into a black hole. And imagine all the sun collapsed down into this radius. Well, then the metric really would be the Schwarzschild radius. And we'd have all of the mass of the sun inside 3 kilometers. This is M sun. Okay, so there are such objects in space. There's an object in the center of the Milky Way. I think its mass is a million times the mass of the Sun, and the Schwarzschild radius is only 3 million kilometers. Okay, it's still a pretty small distance. We can barely see it. That's what Avery is busy doing, trying to see 3 million kilometers at a distance away from us of 30 kiloparsecs or so, 100,000 light years. He's got to see 3 million kilometers. It's a very tall order, but it can just be done. In fact, it's kind of amazing that the size of the Earth is just big enough for an interferometer. You know, the resolution of an interferometer goes inversely with the length scale, and the Earth is just big enough to resolve the black hole in the center of the Milky Way. Very nice, nicely designed, so we can see it. But in general relativity, these things seem to exist. There are objects which presumably were great, big, massive stars that collapsed through their Schwarzschild radius, and they exist. In fact, I'll show you next time a little movie. It's a beautiful movie. I don't know if you've seen it, of stars in the center of our galaxy. Have you seen this movie? Okay, so it should be really famous, this movie. So basically, all we can see are the stars. We can't see the black hole because it's black. But you watch the stars, and I guarantee you'll be convinced there is a black hole there by the motion of the stars. I'll show it to you next time. It's really fun. So we're pretty sure these black holes really exist. Actually, I have to tell you a funny joke, too. Stephen Hawking proved several things about black holes. One is that their area, the area of the horizon, so the horizon is basically the place where the Schwarzschild metric goes singular. The area is, as I've said, the area here is just 4 pi Schwarzschild radius squared. And there are various very powerful theorems involving proved using the equations of general relativity, which is that this area can only increase. So if you take two black holes and they merge, then the combined area has to go up. And that was the original indication that there's something like a black hole law of thermodynamics, and that in fact the area should be thought of as the entropy of the black hole. And the entropy can, in thermodynamics, entropy only increases. And so this was the sort of first indication, the area theorem in GR was the first indication that black holes are somehow connected to entropy. So Stephen Hawking proved various theorems. So then he went to France and gave some lectures about this. He told me about it much later, of course. And he said the French hated black holes. The reason is that if you translate black hole into French, it becomes trou noir, okay? Which is very rude. So the French astrophysicists could not accept that objects exist with such a rude name. So they resisted like mad throughout the 1970s. The French basically refused to believe in black holes because it has this terrible connotation. But yeah, they really do exist. The universe is full of black holes. So, okay, any other questions?
In practice, I know, so to realize that the R equals 2m is coordinate singularity, I guess you can just find coordinates where the metric is not singular.
Correct.
But in practice, is there a way of looking at some other kind of invariant quantity or something that would tell you that
yes, exactly. So, so what I'm claiming here is that this is just a coordinate singularity. And the way So the claim is that's a coordinate singularity. So how would you know without finding, one way is just to look through all the coordinates and find some coordinates where it's not singular, okay? And that's essentially what we'll do in the next couple of lectures. We're going to fall into a black hole, we're going to follow photons into the black hole, and we'll design coordinates in which the black hole is not singular. But without doing that, is there some simpler way you could do it? So let me just ask you. The metric is singular, right? Is there something I could calculate which might tell me whether this is a real singularity or just a coordinate singularity? What could I use?
Determinant.
Pardon?
Determinant.
Determinant of the metric is not great because it's not invariant, you see. So g prime is dx dx prime g, right? So it transforms. So this is not coordinate invariant. So the determinant, well, you know, it doesn't look bad because you see the determinant of the metric is 1, okay, in these coordinates. So because the first and the second terms cancel. The determinant actually doesn't have a coordinate singularity. So, yeah, maybe you'd say that as some kind of indication. It's not really very strong evidence because determinant is not an invariant quantity. What else could I use? Ricci scalar. Now, what about Ricci scalar?
It's 0.
No use at all, okay?
Trace
is not invariant. Keep going with the Ricci. We're on the right lines.
Scalar built from the Riemann.
Ricci tensor was just 0, so that's no use at all. You have this R alpha beta, no use at all. This is 0. Okay, what about R alpha beta mu nu? Now, is that coordinate invariant? No, it's a tensor. But can I make something coordinate invariant from the Riemann tensor?
The Grexnoid?
Sorry? Well, how about itself? How about this? R alpha beta mu nu. That's a scalar. That's the same in any coordinate system. It's not 0. So if you can show this quantity is regular as you cross the short shell radius, that's some indication maybe the short shell radius is not a singularity. Now, actually,
sorry, what does this indicate?
If this quantity is, so this quantity, its numerical value at any point is the same in any coordinate system.
Okay.
Right? So if I work out the Riemann squared here, whatever coordinates I use, I'm going to get 5, if its value is 5. So that's a great quantity because it's just independent of coordinates. Okay? So, I'm saying work this out using that metric, and if it is not singular, if it doesn't blow up at r equals Schwarzschild radius, that would be a good indication that the Schwarzschild radius is really just a coordinate artifact, that there exists some set of coordinates in which the metric is not singular. So now actually when you work that out, I haven't really given you enough to do it, but almost enough. I mean, you have all the Christoffel symbols, so good luck. You can work out Riemann squared. You can certainly get your computer to do that. It's quite straightforward, just to compute this. And when you do it, you'll find that it goes like 1 over r to the fourth. I guess by dimensions, it goes like m squared, g squared, m squared over r to the fourth. Okay, not rs. It's only singular at r equals 0. Okay, so when you looked at the metric, you all saw the singularity when r equals rs, but there's another singularity. That's when r equals 0. And then the coefficient of the dt squared term is infinity, right? In fact, you see when r is less than rs, time is really space because the dt squared has a plus sign outside it. It's positive. So actually t is space inside a black hole, and r is the time inside a black hole, okay? And r equals 0 is the place where there's a curvature singularity, and it can't be removed with coordinates. But you see, the mere fact that r is the time means that when you fall into a black hole, you have no choice. You've got to go to r equals 0 if you're going forward in time means going to smaller radius. And so it turns out for the sun, I believe, if you had a black hole of the size of the sun, I think it's 1.5 seconds you've got. We can more or less see that. Does that make sense? No, that doesn't make sense. It should be just that number over C. Yeah, I think it should be just that number over C is the time. Yeah, sorry. For the black hole in the galaxy center, we would have 3 times 10 to the 9. Yeah, we'd have 10 seconds, right? In the galaxy in the black hole, the black hole in the galaxy center is about this big. And if I fall into it, I'm going to be crushed in a time of this divided by the speed of light, which is about 10 seconds. Okay, so you would have 10 seconds of enlightenment. Yes, black holes exist. I could go into them. Oops. Okay, and anyway, so we're going to do that in the next lecture. We will fall into the black hole and we'll see what's inside it. Now, there's something you should know.
Outside, you all they'd see is an image of you at the horizon.
That's also true, because you notice. We ask this question, what is t? T is the time measured by somebody outside, a long way away from the black hole. The black hole, the surface of the black hole, is the point where the coefficient of that t is going to zero. What that actually means is there's infinite gravitational redshift on the surface. So as I fall towards the black hole, and imagine I'm sending my radio signals off to somebody at infinity, the frequency of my signals are going to redshift, and eventually they're going to go to zero frequency. So what they will see is I will go red as I fall onto the horizon, and the light I'm emitting will become longer and longer wavelength, or the radio waves will become longer and longer wavelengths, and my voice will slow down. And eventually I will just freeze on the horizon of the black hole, and they just see this picture of me for eternity, frozen on the horizon, not doing anything. Okay, so like when a star forms, if we see the black hole in our galaxy center, there literally should, if you had sufficiently good telescopes, you would see a picture on the surface of the star that collapsed to make that black hole, going redder and redder and redder as it approaches the horizon. Yeah.
From an observer outside the black hole, does the infalling observer actually cross the horizon?
No.
So how do we interpret, like, we have black hole accretion, so how does that work?
We see the stuff circulating around the black hole, and we see, as it falls in.
We don't see it fall in.
We never see it actually fall in. We see it slowing down and frozen on the surface. At the moment it falls in, it's just frozen.
Does it? I thought when we have...
So we would see it fall in at infinite time, if you like.
Yeah,
that's
but
all.
Do we not see accretion increasing the mass and hence the radius at the black hole, which we can't do if the stuff isn't actually falling in?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Do we see the black hole mass, black hole horizon increasing? It's a good question. I think we do.
Similarly,
do.
Two black holes merging.
Okay. Yeah.
You get the same problem that they'd never actually merge as seen from an external observer.
They certainly do merge. So, I mean, people like Luis do numerical simulations where the black holes orbit each other, give off gravitational waves, and you measure those, and then there's a chirp as they finally approach and merge. So there's certainly a very clear signal that they're merging. But your question is, do we really see the horizon settle down to that of a perfect black hole? I think the answer is yes. But I think it's in the following sense, the black hole horizon will be emitting radiation, for example, from the last thing that fell into it. but radiation of an ever-growing wavelength.
But you said the last thing that fell into it, but from an observer who is not from us,
yes.
Nothing falls into it. Because it always freezes on the horizon.
It only falls into it asymptotically. Okay. So basically, whatever falls into it goes redder and redder and redder, and then we stop seeing radiation from it, even though we can't actually see the moment at which it falls in. Okay. Yeah, that's the best I can do. Yeah, so we'll study this next time.
I mean, you say the photon gets redder and redder, so it actually disappears. I mean, from quantum mechanics, you know, this is what happens. Like, is it possible to have photon and there's no photon?
Is it possible to have? Oh, I see. So somebody's carrying a torch. And they fall into a black hole. The torch, I'm saying the torch gets redder and redder and redder. So classically, you would see like continuous radiation, but just going to redder and redder wavelengths. Now, quantum mechanically, the quanta of light, as the wavelength gets longer, the quanta gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So, yeah. So as they're approaching the horizon, you're seeing less and less coming from them, and eventually you're seeing so little coming from them that you can't even detect it.
So
yeah, just because of finite resolution of your detector, at some point they will appear black.
So the clock of someone at the horizon appears to go infinitely slow,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Because that's why asymptotically they've stopped.
Exactly. And you can't see them.
You can't see them.
Yeah, that's right.
And can I just also ask, regarding like what
question
Kieran asked about the two black holes that
yes.
Were, when they collapse, do we mean by them
collide.
Merging?
Yeah.
Is that essentially the internal structure has combined? Can we make any comments? I suppose based on what we've discussed, we can't make any comment about the external.
Well, the comment we can make is that when they merge, so when they're merging, in the process of merging, they're emitting gravitational waves. The only way for them to stop emitting gravitational waves is if they become spherically symmetric. Because a source with without symmetry is going to radiate gravitational waves. So basically, it's very plausible, and you see this in numerical simulations, that when black holes merge, they keep emitting energy until they become more and more spherical. The combined object becomes more and more spherical. And as time goes forward, eventually it really settles into a spherically symmetric static black hole. It's a unique endpoint which doesn't emit any gravitational waves. So yeah, we believe black holes settle down. Now, I've simplified with spherical symmetry. In fact, the statements I've just made are wrong. They settle down to a Kerr metric, not a Schwarzschild. Okay, so it's still unique, but a Schwarzschild is unique metric that is spherically symmetric. If you say I've got angular momentum in the object, in other words, it's only axially symmetric, then the most general axially symmetric solution of the vacuum Einstein equations is the Kerr metric. And this Kerr metric will not radiate gravitational waves. It'll represent a rotating black hole. That doesn't, it just sits there forever, according to classical GR. And that's what we believe all the black holes in the universe. So Schwarzschild is not actually generic because it isn't rotating. A Kerr metric is generic. It's more complicated metric. But it's unique. So the theorems that have been proven about black holes is that the most general... I think I better stop. Let me talk more next time. All right. So I think you probably need a break. But I can't stop you asking questions.